This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So they're supportive of all of these things that Chesa Boudin has done, yet there's a contingent that does not support him generally because they've been misinformed, right? They've been told that he's responsible for an increase in crime, but we know that increase isn't even happening. We know that he's also not responsible for the decrease in crime that I've described in that thread and now on this show.
More than 20 years ago, sociologist Barry Glassner wrote his bestseller, The Culture of Fear, where he explains why Americans tend to be unreasonably afraid of things like crime, drugs, people of color, immigrants, teenagers, etc. He writes, "The short answer to why Americans harbor so many misbegotten fears is that immense power and money await those who tap into our moral insecurities and supply us with symbolic substitutes." This week on Sea Change Radio, the second half of our discussion with San Francisco Deputy Public Defender Peter Galloway. We delve further into the danger of cherry-picked crime statistics, look at the upcoming recall election of San Francisco's relatively new district attorney, Chesa Boudin, and examine the recent recall trend in the nation's most populous state. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Peter Galloway. Peter is a public defender in San Francisco. Peter, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So as a public defender in the city the size of San Francisco, Peter, you work with people who have crimes perpetrated against them and perpetrate them. And the idea that you would be quote-unquote soft on crime, I think, is pretty preposterous, and as you mentioned, but we can't be offended if we want to change hearts and minds, can we?
Oh, no, certainly not, and I really don't let it bother me. I was actually somewhat pleased by the extent to which the responses to this thread, you know, which were numerous, right? It got much more attention than I ever would have predicted, but that the responses to this, even the ones that were sort of hateful and not in good faith, didn't affect me. I wasn't sure that would be true, but it was. And maybe part of that is because I'm sort of, as a public defender, as somebody with politics like I do around these issues, I'm used to, as a starting point, having people react negatively to some of the positions that I hold, right? And I've spent a long time with family and friends and others having conversations around these issues. And with some time, I think people who are acting in good faith will come to understand the realities that those of us who have studied this have come to learn, right? Which is, again, that you can't prosecute or jail or imprison your way out of a mental health or poverty or trauma crisis. Almost all of the people who commit crimes as defined, right, by society, setting aside that whole conversation about who gets to call what crime, but almost everybody who is accused of crime has been a victim themselves, right? It is frustrating that there are a lot of people who are really, really vocal about what they've identified as problems in this city and beyond it, who have not spent the time to sort of interrogate whether the things that they want to do in response to that are likely to make the problem better or worse.
So, Peter, you mentioned that the thing that kind of sparked your ire online was this Washington Post piece by Scott Wilson. You and Scott went back and forth after your thread. Why don't you kind of encapsulate that exchange?
You know, as I told him in our sort of back and forth on Twitter, I have nothing against him. But I do think that his piece and the way that it wrote about particularly this issue was harmful, right? you know, he responded initially sort of demanding that I tell him where I said that, where he said that crime was out of control and the like. And I responded, you know, screenshotting the part where he said that it's jumped by double digit increases. And he was kind and sort of, well, he reached out the following day, I think, also on Twitter. And, you know, I sort of apologized for the way he reacted, but defended the reporting and said, you know, if you'd be interested in meeting, I would like to do that. And so at some point, you know, when he's back in the city, he and I will meet, which I think will be great. I'll be honest, I probably should have done this by now. I haven't gone and read the rest of his writing on this sort of subject in San Francisco and elsewhere. So I don't know if this decision is sort of representative of a pattern of that type of reporting. So I won't speak to that. But what I will say is...
What does it say about this type of reporting in general? And how can journalists do better?
One thing it says about this type of reporting is, you know, I think journalists often have a tendency toward the sensational, right? It's perhaps more interesting to write an article about the Tenderloin or some other neighborhood in some other city where you're talking about, you know, crime being out of control. People are going to want to read that, you know, fear generates headlines. That's a pretty cynical view, right?
But it's similar to what we were talking about with the political process, with the low-hanging fruit of being soft on crime in a Supreme Court confirmation hearing.
Right, right.
It makes people feel better about themselves. And it's also the sensationalist side of human nature, that curiosity to want to be able to be outraged about something.
Right. And also, you know, a lot of these papers are owned by very wealthy people or owned by corporations more and more, right? And so I think there's probably individual level biases by reporters, but also there are editorial choices made all the time, right? And those are more political. Those, I think, are more designed at entrenching this status quo that protects, you know, the sort of inequality that we've allowed to emerge in this society, that protects the sort of propertied wealthy against the sort of dispossessed masses. And, it, you know, I'll name that friend again, because he's done some really great work on Twitter, Alec Karakatsanis, really doing deep dives into a lot of crime reporting. And he usually starts by listing in order in which they appear the sources used in these articles. And it's really horrific. I noticed somebody, he'll list these sources, right? And it's like store owner who wants people prosecuted more, and police spokesperson, and beat cop, and politician pushing tough on crime policy. And, you know, almost never do you have somebody giving a different perspective. And this is in the New York Times, it's in the Washington Post, it's in the Chronicle.
If you were going to label these different perspectives, what would be some good examples?
Of alternative perspectives?
Yeah, so like as opposed to the beat cop or the industry spokesperson or the person who witnessed the crime, let's say.
Well, there are a lot of community organizations who are doing work at reducing harm, you know, in cities across the country. They'll feature often. So you could, you know, if you're going to invite a police officer to comment on what they see as the right solution, you could also invite somebody who has another solution. You could, instead of only inviting sort of criminologists who push pro-police narratives and literature, you can invite any of the number of well-respected scholars who have conducted some of the studies I referenced earlier about the connection between imprisonment and lower life expectancy in the general population.
Or a public defender.
Or a public defender, right? And that's one of the things, actually, the Washington Post article had comment from the mayor and the district attorney. It did not have a comment from Mano Raju, who's the public defender in San Francisco. One could imagine, you know, such commentary being somewhat illuminating, and you would think that it'd be pretty basic to see that, okay, we have this adversarial criminal legal system, and on one side you have the DA. I'm going to invite that person on. I feel like there's someone on the other side. I can't quite put my finger on it, but if I could identify that person, maybe I should have them on too, you know?
But if you watch the local news, they're trying to turn these things over quickly, and it's become a formula. Get the witness, get a spokesperson, maybe one other person, and then run with it. What you're talking about takes an extra step, and it's so critical to take that extra step, but it's so often overlooked.
I think that's a good point, and that probably some of this can be explained by, you know, the path of least resistance or less charitably laziness. But this exists in deeply reported pieces as well, right?
That's true, yes.
So I really do think it's a bit of both, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it is the explanation you offer, but it's also a political choice driven and sometimes by the personal biases of the reporter and sometimes by the biases of the newsroom.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to San Francisco public defender Peter Calloway. In the time we have left, I wanted to touch briefly upon the concept of recall elections. You mentioned San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, how he was elected in 2019, started serving in 2020, and he's already up for a recall election. And we saw this recently. A lot of the country tuned in to Gavin Newsom's recall election for governor. This is how Arnold Schwarzenegger rose to the role of governor when Gray Davis was recalled back in the early 2000s. It's not a system that every state has. Maybe you can kind of explain how it's become used as a cudgel by loud vocal minority in this state.
Sure. I didn't follow the gubernatorial recall super closely, nor the school board recall, but closely enough to know that, you know, in the district attorney recall campaign, right, one of the biggest funders is a right-wing billionaire hedge fund manager named William Obendorf. There's an article, I think, today in SF Gate about this, who's donated more than $1 million to the Republican Party to keep Republicans in power, to put Republicans in power of the Senate. He was also one of the largest donors, as I understand it, to the school board recall, right? I don't know about his involvement in the recall campaign against Governor Newsom, but it's a technically legal process that I still think is sort of subversive to a true sort of representative democracy.
maybe I'll summarize it for listeners and correct me if I miss something. But my understanding is that, I forget the percentages, but it's pretty low in terms of signatures. It's a fairly insignificant hurdle to get over. And if you pay, a lot of these for-profit signature mills, if you will, are out there. People who you'd find in front of a grocery store trying to collect recall elections, they don't necessarily believe in the issue that they're campaigning for, but they're just collecting signatures and they're getting, let's say, $4 a signature, I think, is what I've had conversations with people in front of grocery stores. They're just trying to get signatures so that they can get these new elections, which are quite costly and kind of anti-democratic in that we're constantly in a state of election here in California or in San Francisco. There's always an election every 4 to 6 months. It's not every 2 years anymore by any means.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really problematic. And to your point, right, we know that you can sort of buy your way into a petition, into onto the ballot, right? Because like you said, you give people a financial incentive to go out there and raise. I think the Boudin recall got something like 80,000 petitions, right? So that's not nothing, right? There's no denying that. But a number of those people signed a thing that they probably didn't quite understand. And often they're sort of hurried and given this, you know, more sort of innocuous petition about an unrelated issue and then asked to quickly sign this other thing too, right? So, and it is extremely costly. But then, of course, the recall proponents will point to the petition numbers as some sort of indicator of huge support, which again, even among people who are making the conscious decision to support this recall effort, a huge number of them have been duped, frankly, right? Because they're reading reporting that says crime is up, crime is out of control, police are the solution to crime and the rest, and they're ignoring or having obscured the reality, which again was the sort of reason I started to write about this. I mean, I don't know if I cited these earlier, right? But the numbers are, what is it? Violent crime decreased by 19% since the start of the pandemic, or since 2019, rather. Property crime down 11%. So these are just not the numbers that your average listener or your average reader of certainly of establishment media would understand.
And it can be cherry-picked to mean the opposite, as you demonstrated earlier when you were talking about the Washington Post piece.
Right. Yeah, and it often is. But so one thing that I think is important in response to this recall effort, particularly, is to say, even on your own terms, right, even in a world where we credit the definitions of crime that we use sort of historically, and where we assume that the responses to them that we've most commonly employed could have some impact. Even in that world, on those terms, the numbers are not what you say they are, right? The numbers are not what the recall people say they are. And this is, of course, setting aside also the question whether there's any evidence to show that the district attorney has any impact on crime rates. And there isn't. In fact, there's a study, I forget the author's name, but it's referenced in a recent article in the Chronicle by Susie Nielsen, who's their data reporter, showing that there's no connection between the DA's politics or policies, whether there's somebody who would be categorized as a progressive prosecutor or not, and rates of crime in their jurisdiction.
And we're talking about within 6 months of Boudin serving, there was already a recall petition circulating. I mean, this was not based on data by any means. This was much more of a red versus blue type framing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at the policies that Boudin ran on and the policies that he's put into place since coming to office, by and large, these are very popular, right? I don't remember offhand the numbers, but people people are supportive of ending cash bail. People understand, because of great work by organizers to sort of combat these issues and some lawyers who have challenged them across the country, the fundamental unfairness between conditioning a person's ability to be free while they're waiting for trial on an ability to pay an amount of money. People are supportive of a policy where we don't prosecute kids as adults because of the brain science showing that until you're basically 25, your brain is still developing. There's impulse control issues and the like. People are supportive of policies to reduce racial disparities in the system, right? So they're supportive of all of these things that Chesa Boudin has done, yet there's a contingent that does not support him generally because they've been misinformed, right? They've been told that he's responsible for an increase in crime, but we know that increase isn't even happening. We know that he's also not responsible for the decrease in crime that I've described in that thread and now on this show.
Because we talked about how criminals are not committing crimes based on who the prosecutor is of these crimes.
Right. There's that. Like, people aren't making decisions before the fact based on those sorts of factors.
Right. The person who was committing that crime in the Walgreens wasn't looking at the election returns on election night and said, oh, Chesa Boudin's in there. It's going to be great shoplifting at Walgreens next week. That's just not how they wanted to get some stuff out of Walgreens, thought they could get away with it, and they weren't prosecuted for it. But the district attorney was not a part of their calculus, let's just say.
Right. And it's not going to be part of the calculation, you know, if there's a next time either. I mean, the notion also that he's somehow ignoring these issues, right? I suspect he understands that prosecuting petty thefts by poor people is not going to resolve the problem of people committing petty thefts. But he's doing it because there's a loud segment of the city that seems to want that. And it hasn't changed anything, and it won't, right? And of course, we've also learned that these stores, right, who claim that they're so impacted by this theft problem that they have to shut down their locations have been revealed to have been lying about that too, right? There's an article in, I think, The Examiner and also an online publication called The Appeal, which after this whole farcical kind of hearing at the Board of Supervisors where these corporate representatives were allowed to come in and say that theft has really hurt them and caused them to have to move, it was uncovered that, I think it was Walgreens and perhaps others, but had planned these closures as part of a sort of restructuring to increase profits, right? So they conveniently used, with the help of Supervisor Safai and others, this cover, this crime cover, to obscure the fact that they were making a financially motivated decision to shut down stores, knowing that it would impact people in those communities and their ability to get their medicine and their necessities. But hey, let's blame it on the poor folks.
He's a public defender in San Francisco, Peter Calloway. Peter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm happier than the morning sun. That's the way you said that it would be. If I should ever bring you inside my life, I'm happier than the morning sun.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and with the additional time that we have on this week's show, I thought I would read an opinion piece from the San Francisco Examiner talking about the Chesa Boudin recall election. It's by the paper's editor, Gil Duran. It's entitled, Chesa Boudin Derangement Syndrome Grips SF Politics. Scapegoating San Francisco DA Boudin won't reduce crime, but voters may do it anyway. Skipping to the second half of this piece, I support holding politicians accountable, and I believe that people who depend on public approval for their jobs tend to get what's coming to them. But the local outbreak of what some call Chesa Boudin Derangement Syndrome is on another level. It's absurd because one relatively green politician, who's only held office for 2 years, cannot logically bear responsibility for decades of societal failure. Addiction, crime, and poverty existed here 150 years before Boudin's ascension, and will persist after he fades into history. In today's San Francisco, however, everything seems to be the fault of Boudin. That's because Boudin is more than a public official. He's a symbol. Born to parents with infamous Weather Underground roots, educated at elite universities, he's a bit like radical royalty. This pedigree might normally help him in a progressive city, but he's an outsider here. His narrow victory upset a local political establishment with cliquish manners and a long memory. He benefited from the city's convoluted ranked choice voting process, beating the mayor's hand-picked favorite Susie Loftus by just over 1 point. His close win signaled a key victory for the national movement to elect more progressive DAs, but timing is everything. The COVID pandemic, a national spike in violent crime, and surging drug overdose deaths all provide his opponents with plentiful fodder to use against him. He also earned the ruthless scorn of the police union when he righteously decided to uphold his pledge to prosecute police brutality. Of course, the police union also despised his predecessors. Today, the DA gets blamed for everything. In addition, wealthy donors like Republican billionaire William Oberndorf, a main funder of the Boudin recall, have taken an increasingly active interest in manipulating the city's politics. They see Boudin as an easy target, and maybe they're right. But would his defeat be a victory for good government or propaganda? And then skipping to the end, in 2022, polls show Californians are worried about crime. A recent UC Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies poll found 65% of Californians believe crime has increased in their area, with 51% saying Newsom has done a poor or very poor job on the issue. Wait a second. If this is a statewide sentiment, how does it make sense to hold Boudin in particular accountable? The answer is that it doesn't have to make sense. Politics ain't fair. Disgruntled San Franciscans will saddle Boudin with blame and put him out to pasture unless he finds a way to change the narrative. Toppling Boudin wouldn't solve our problems, of course. Drugs, robbery, and crime will continue to sully our wonderful bastion of extreme economic inequality, as always. We'll just need someone else to blame. This complicates things for Mayor London Breed, the most likely future target of our collective wrath. Surely she must grasp the peril she will face if we don't have Boudin to kick around anymore. So that's from Gil Duran, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Examiner. And it's worth noting that since my discussion with Peter Calloway, the San Francisco Chronicle has also endorsed Boudin in his recall effort. Thanks again for joining us on Sea Change Radio. Please tune in next week.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Les McCann and Eddie Harris, War, and Stevie Wonder. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.